listening to a Lilith podcast. You can subscribe to Lilith Magazine, independent, Jewish, and frankly feminist, at www.lilith.org, where you can also find the Daily Lilith blog, other great podcasts, information on ordering back issues, and much, much more. Just click on www.lilith.org. Hi, Lilith podcast listeners. You're about to be privy to something very special. Excerpts of lectures given by three scholars of American Jewish history and an exclusive event held by Lilith Magazine and the American Jewish Historical Society on the 12th of April, 2010. We hope you enjoy these special selections. For more information, go to www.lilith.org.
So, folks, can we please all sit down because we actually don't have all that much time. And we need to get started for the last session. Okay? And now that you all know each other, I know it's going to be a little harder. I want to do something a little different in this session because we're moving into territory that all of you know by virtue of being American Jews, living in the United States, having experienced the 20th century. So it's not foreign territory to you. And yet, at the same time, of course, there are some things that you don't know, that historians discover using the archives. And as Annie said at the very beginning, one of the things that's exciting about these sessions is the encounter with materials and the kinds of questions that you get to ask from the materials. So what I want to do for this session is I'm going to speak very briefly to highlight a couple of points for you about the 20th century, and then I want you to take the boxes, which is why I had those boxes put out there, and take a look at what's in them. And I'm going to ask you to share with all of us what it is that you're discovering in those boxes. So I'm going to want to give you some time, actually, to read a little bit, all right? Or to look at the images, because there are boxes now that have photographs. I mean, photography is invented in the 19th century, but we don't really start to get large numbers of photographs until the 20th. So we have those in the archives as well. Several important changes that happened in the 20th century. First of all, the 20th century is the time when American Jewish women organize. They organize along class lines. They organize along political lines. They organize locally and nationally. And some of them even organize internationally. So the big organizations that some of you, I hope, have heard of, National Council of Jewish Women, you've all heard of that? National Council? Yes? Okay. Organize. It starts in the 1890s. It initially has a very much a sort of self-education component to it. The early meetings, the women took it upon themselves to study things like Spinoza, right, and to read papers and discussion with each other. And this was because women weren't going to high school in those years. It was not an easy thing to get your parents, even middle-class parents, to let you go to high school if you were a girl. So these organizations became a place where women could learn. But once they started learning, they also wanted to do. Hadassah. How many of you heard of Hadassah? Everybody heard of Hadassah? Okay, good. We've got Hadassah papers here. We have National Council papers here. Hadassah starts in 1912. It, too, has an education component, very much a Jewish education component, to teach its members about Jewish history and the importance of Zionism. It is a political organization, as the National Council becomes. So politics comes to matter in this period, and it continues to matter on up through the years after World War II. So we have papers here from the American Jewish Congress, and especially its women's division. Women's Division was an important wing of the Congress that gets started after the war, led by Justine Wise Pollier. And I think you'll see some of that. A very important lawyer and influential figure. And she takes the Women's Division along with people who follow her, like Jackie Levine, into civil rights activism and a rather somewhat separate stance from that of the organization itself. Just as Hadassah had taken a separate stance from the American Zionist, the ZOA, the Zionist Organization of America, from the various other versions of Zionism that flourished in the United States. Hadassah, when it went to provide health care, was very progressive. Annie mentioned about the sort of imbibing of a progressive ideology, and that meant that they were non-sectarian. It meant that their services were for Jews and Arabs. Hadassah refused, although many of the other Zionists in Palestine in the 1920s wanted them to just provide services to Jews, refused to do that. Right? It was going to be for everybody. That was their American ideology at work. The fact that they focused on women and children was a reflection of their being a women's organization. So this is a period of women organizing. Women organizing in a wide array of areas. Now, I didn't bring materials from any of the unions. I didn't bring, just a sampling of some of the women's organizational materials. This is also a period, 20th century, where Jewish women achieve renown as individuals, prominence. They achieve prominence as intellectuals, and we have one example here with Lucy Davidovich's papers. So I don't know if they're around. She is a woman who does manage to go to high school and even to college. She goes to Hunter College. Hunter College in New York City was the sort of female equivalent to City College. Much less attention has been paid to Hunter College and its intellectual world, but it was very, very important in the 20s and 30s, just as City College was for those men and who went there. It was important for women. Famous people, Bella Abzug, others, went there. So did Lucy. She went to Hunter, and then she took a year at the YIVO in Vilna, 1938-39, academic year. Incredibly important, changed her whole sort of perspective on what it meant to be involved in the Jewish world. And one of the things that we're going to see here are elements of American Jews deeply involved in a much larger world. With Hadassah, it's not just Palestine and then Israel, but also Europe, and especially in the 30s with Youth Aliyah. With the National Council of Jewish Women, they're definitely involved with immigrants, as well as with what goes on in Europe in the larger pre-World War II feminist movement. And with Lucy Davidovich, it was this discovery of this incredibly rich world of Yiddish that she brought back to the United States and shaped her as a public intellectual. So those are just a couple of the sort of characteristics of the 20th century. As I said, I'm not going to talk a lot, but I want you now, let's take 5 minutes or so, open up the boxes, look at them, and then I'm going to ask you what it is that you're seeing. And let's see if we can't do some interpretation of what you're seeing, okay? I want to ask you first, what is it that you're seeing?
In this box on the Lower East Side, we have photographs of how people lived, the shops, how they bought things, what they bought, the jobs people had, exterminators, weavers.
Okay, so in that box you're seeing photographs of a place, the Lower East Side, that
trades.
Is identified. What?
The trades.
And the trades.
Go ahead. Hebrew and or Yiddish signage.
Mm-hmm.
Signage.
Okay. Do you have men or women in those pictures?
Women.
You know, okay, so you can look at the signage. Some of the signage is in Yiddish, right? Some of the signage is in English, okay? There's much to interpret in this photograph, right, or in the bunch of photographs that were taken. Those were taken as part of a project done by someone in the School of Social Work. And the motivation actually behind the project, and I don't know that you can see it in the images, was that this neighborhood was disappearing. And if we didn't take pictures quickly, right, the neighborhood would be gone. And so that's what he was doing, trying to document a fading way of immigrant life.
One photographer?
It was one photographer, yeah, who did this project. Okay, what else you see? Yeah.
I have amazing letters by Lucy Davidowitz when she was in the 1947 actually working for American Joint Distribution, looking at books that were Jewish books that had been looted by the Nazis that she's describing that were in Czechoslovakia or Prague and different places. It looks like she's going place to place trying to catalog books that were Jewish books that were looted by the Nazis.
Okay, that's great. So one of the things that she does after the war is she's part of an American Jewish effort to reclaim material, Jewish materials, because there are not many Jews left in Europe who can reclaim these materials. And so American Jews mounted several reclamation projects. And Lucy, as well as Hannah Arendt, whose papers we don't have here, were part of teams that went through Europe right after the war, attempting to find that material so they could put a claim on it for Jewish organizations. It was, we might say then, an expression of Jewish peoplehood, right, that says we're connected to these materials even though we live in the United States. And we're not necessarily the original owner. So it brings up some really interesting information. What is that written? Is that written by hand or in typewriter?
It's typed, very okay. Lengthy letters typed.
Okay.
And she seems aware that this is important material because in the first sentence it says, in years to come, this will be a very valuable circular letter of mine.
Okay, so this is good. All right. In fact,
she seems to be aware of it.
Okay, that's, yes, she was definitely aware of its historic importance. It is only very, very recently that anyone has paid any attention to this material. Very recently. So years to come, it's been a lot of years. So we see from that letter then the issue of audience and the who it is that someone is writing for and the ways in which that too affects. So both of these documents actually convey a sense that American Jews had, some of them at least, that they were living in historic times and they needed somehow to document it, whether through the photographs of a neighborhood that was changing or through reclamation efforts in the wake of the genocide of World War II. Okay, who else? Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sure. Holding a letter that's probably written 8 weeks later by a colleague, a different person on the same subject, another lengthy letter, but it's her argument, and it's stated in very emotional terms, that there is no point in looking for the owners anymore because they've been exterminated and it is not worth the effort, and it's, you know, it's a very heartbreaking letter, and then it's crossed out at the top and says, never sent.
Oh. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
So you can sort of hear the conversation, the argument going on before.
That's right. And a kind of self-censorship, right? The issue of ownership is a really important issue, right? There were Jews who come back after the war to reclaim property.
Still
and
going on now.
It's still going on now, that's correct. So the question of to whom does this belong is not easily answered, right? So partly what you can find then in the archives is not just the public record, but also the private one, those thoughts. Okay, what else are we seeing? Yeah, back there.
At this end of the table, we have very modern materials from the 50s, she's got from the 80s and 90s, and it's just such ephemera, you'd think it would go in the garbage after a year or two. And it kind of points out that every day there are documents coming out that probably should be held on to. Even if it just looks like a photograph of 200 women sitting at a banquet. Yeah, but with a magnifying glass, you can probably pick it out who they are.
Okay, that's actually a very interesting photograph in the sense that it's all women, right? There are in other, I'm sure, collections you would find photographs of mixed groups and ways of talking about American Jews and the relations between men and women that you can read from some of those photographs. So yes, what appears to be ephemera, because we don't yet have the distance on it, is often very much also worth collecting. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we have a lot of Hadassah dialogues here.
Okay, and what do you learn from that?
On a lot of contemporary issues, the mid-20th century, the founding of the United Nations House on American Activities Committee, so it just really shows you Hadassah was a very effective thought. But what sort of fascinates me, we were just saying there are carbon copies here. People use the expression carbon copy all the time, but I'm sure no one understands.
That's very true. The CC, right? The carbon copy, yes, or going to somebody as well. Okay, I want to touch on what you mentioned in terms of the politics. Hadassah, like the National Council, like the American Jewish Congress Women, these were political organizations. They were not just philanthropic organizations. In the years of second wave feminism, many of the Jewish women's organizations were dismissed by younger women, my generation, as only concerned with philanthropy, as only interested in fashion, fashion shows to raise money, as not engaged in any kind of serious politics. But when you go back and you see stuff about the House Un-American Activities Committee and you see other kinds of political engagement, you begin to recognize that these organizations were, we might say, training grounds for Jewish women to get involved in politics. And that politics, American politics, not just Jewish politics, but American politics was an important piece of what it was they did. So we're beginning to recognize that it's far more complicated, our view of these organizations there. Okay, what else have we seen? Yes.
Saying a minute ago about how politically active Hadassah and National Council of Jewish Women, etc., were in their time, and the second wave feminists. I mean, Lilith ran an article in one of our first issues about volunteer organizations, vanguard or rear guard,
right,
and how terribly stifling they were, etc., etc., in the late 70s. But the truth of the matter is that we went through Lilith's archival collection, and thank God for sort of filing and forgetting, because these are things that when we began to dig out the Lilith archives a couple of years ago in 7 gazillion boxes. There are letters in there about organizational meetings from the mid-70s until about the mid-80s where, for example, Hadassah would not take a stance in favor of abortion rights for fear of alienating ultra-Orthodox women, or even just mainstream Orthodox women. So some of that back and forth is really fascinating, not just that younger women painted with concealer, the proud history, but also that history did shift back and forth a lot. So there's stuff to be added even along the way, but you see from the reproductive rights files here how the organizations differentiated one from the other and which ones really did carry that progressive banner for throughout their history, or almost.
Okay, that's I think some wonderful comments about the American Jewish Congress and especially its women's wing, which, as I said, went off on a slightly different path from that of the mainstream Congress itself, and it does raise issues about how organizations change, right? How they continue to recruit women to join them or not? What has happened as a result of second wave feminism, which I think is another important question to ask, because many of the Jewish women's organizations suffered tremendously once Jewish women re-entered the workforce, as they began to do in large numbers starting in the 1970s. So the organizations were built upon an important premise, an American premise, that said you were middle class if your husband could support the family. And in the 1970s, that premise begins to get undermined, first by the women's movement that wants to allow women a chance at equality, but also it starts to get undermined because, as I'm sure many of you have read in today's economic climate, you begin to no longer have the incredible growth of the middle class that had characterized the post-war years. You get stagnation, so that if families actually want to continue to move up or to maintain a middle-class lifestyle, they're actually going to begin to need the income from working wives and mothers. Yeah, what do you have?
I was married in 52. In 53, all my friends, women, stayed home. That was the year. After the war, when the women went to work during the war, and when the war was over, those of us that had married them, almost all of us stayed home. And that's when these organizations became very important for women who were home to exercise their thought processes and everything. So it's very interesting, but my children, my daughters, all work outside the home. So it was definitely a generational thing.
Mm-hmm.
Did your mother work outside?
Yes, my mother was
exactly.
A teacher.
So basically,
the
exception to the rule was the post-war boom.
The post-war boom.
It wasn't like that before, and
nope.
It's not like that
correct.
After.
No, actually, there were, maybe your mother worked as a teacher, but there were certainly a lot of women in the 1920s as well, the teens in the 20s, who had middle class lifestyles who did not work. So it varies, but in the 50s, absolutely. Jewish women, very, very small percentage of married Jewish women worked outside
right,
the home.
The question, just to clarify, the middle class in the 20s and the teens was Tony.
Oh, yes.
Okay?
Oh, yes,
so
that's
most
correct.
So those immigrant women who came over were working.
Of course, they were in the
so
working class, yes.
The middle class is defined by, I suppose, or was defined in the 20th century as women didn't work, however big or small the middle class was, but because it was such a boom after
that's
World
right.
War II, and it was engineered this way with the GI Bill.
That's right.
That the middle class grew.
Yes, that's right. The GI Bill was very important for the
but it was
economic.
This was the middle class, and the expansion of it was socially engineered.
That's correct. That's correct. It was socially engineered, and it did provide, I mean, the post-war years are the years of these organizations becoming mass membership organizations. Before that, they were not mass membership in the same way. But Hadassah reaches, 350,000 members, which is its peak in these years. Prior to that, it's much, much smaller. So, in fact, it becomes the largest American women's organization. Not American Jewish, but American women's organization. And the largest mass membership Jewish organization as well. So on both of those counts in those years. So there's a lot to be learned about that period of time and what kinds of opportunities these organizations provided women to exercise their business skills, their political commitments, their creative interests, their social desires. A whole array of things could take place within the framework of gendered organizations. And you picked, which ones you wanted to do, depending on who you were and what your politics or family background or what whatever it was. Okay, yes.
Yeah, I know that this is paper, oriented toward paper.
Yes.
How does the historical perspective, I'm a filmmaker, so how does the historical perspective take into consideration things that were not recorded to my, well, they were. For example, I was part of the feminist theater. It was a marginal thing. How did it get into the archives, I'd like to know? Does it ever get into the archives?
Well, I know that the one of the collecting initiatives of the American Jewish Historical Society is the Jewish counterculture. And that depends upon how does it get into the art. It depends upon people being willing to donate materials from that. So what you called initially ephemera from the 80s might be the, quote, ephemera of the 70s or 60s that now no longer we recognize as ephemera because we can see connections that were made from what happened in that first feminist Seder and subsequent ones that go on. It's difficult to see maybe from the 80s what's relevant there. But I will tell you, for example, one of my graduate students is really interested in single Jewish women. Right? And she wants to know about how attitudes changed toward single Jewish women. What is the effect of birth control, of Roe v. Wade, of the feminist movement, of, you know, radical lesbian feminism, on these attitudes that Jewish women had toward not getting married? Because there is, statistically, a growing cohort of Jewish women who do not marry. And when she mentioned it to me, I was sort of surprised. But think, you know, this is research of the 70s and 80s that she's really interested in. And there's material out there. Some of it you would consider merely ephemera, but others of it are debates, letters, you know, a sense of who one is as a woman and a Jew at a time when the assumption was that everyone married. Right?
And then
and then became a mother. That's correct. That's right. That's right. So, okay, yes.
Mm-hmm. I was unmarried, and people that I intended to stay in Israel to do a kind of work in development over there, and I just faced everybody that I met said it was kind of like, what's wrong with you? You're 3 years old. Why aren't you married? What's the problem? And I was like, married? Why would I be married? I'm not ready to be married yet. I'm still doing my own thing. But I felt it's not exactly abused, but uncomfortable. Mm-hmm, yeah, that mm-hmm. You know, I eventually returned to the U.S. in a much shorter time than I would have. My question to you is: this is fascinating about these organizations and the political. My mother was involved with all this leftist stuff. Mm-hmm. American Jewish Congress. Has this been actually written about? Studied?
Yes, some of it has. There's begun to be some histories of Hadassah. There's a couple of histories of the National Council. Most of them cover the first half of the 20th century, not the post-World War II years. Joyce Antler, who's a scholar who's written a history of Jewish women in the United States, is now working specifically on a book that looks at Jewish women's involvement in left-wing and specifically feminist organizations in the post-World War II period. But there's material in her other book. Chasya Diner, whom you heard earlier, has some discussion in the book that she wrote I think with Beryl Satter, on Jewish women in the United States. So there's been some research. Not a lot.
She's a
Yes, that's right. In the earlier part, that's right. In the earlier part of the 20th century, there's a good deal written on women's involvement in settlement house movement. There are some interesting biographies of Lillian Wald and women involved in birth control and stuff. So there is some scholarship out there, more on the period prior to World War II than on the period since, but increasingly it's coming. All right, I want to ask about a couple more things that you found. Is your hand up about? Oh, good,
yes.
Okay.
Yes. Very poetic.
Good.
Because I have hidden text. Gum wrappers.
Aha.
Juicy fruit.
Okay.
Juicy fruit gum wrappers. And it, to me, it's just amazing that this is here. You could look at it and easily talk about ephemera, how this didn't end up in a garbage can. I don't know. But here it is, Soviet jewelry. Someone who must have been there and taken some notes, telephone numbers, back here. Something about a Senate subcommittee, mm-hmm, there's a person's mm-hmm. name. But all of this written on the back of a juicy fruit gum wrapper.
Okay. Well, that's great. That's a hidden story in which what we would say is completely ephemeral actually becomes part of Jewish political action.
Well,
and yes.
I feel very shaky having this because when I was in the Soviet Union in 1977, I was approached in Odessa by someone who wanted me to take something back to the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And I had many days ahead of me visiting relatives, and the mixture of feelings, I mean, the fear about doing this and jeopardizing family that was there. So.
Okay.
That I
had That's great. Yes, what do you have?
I had a, it looks like it was Xeroxed or something, Hadassah, April 1942, part of the war effort, and part of it is consumption, and eat soybeans, and use vegetable leftovers in your soup, and what we can learn about women around the world. In the Soviet Union, women have full participation in the economy, the Palestinian Brigade, women are active as clerks. The paper itself, which was red, white, and blue, had like this union label.
Yes, the union bug. Right, so that too gave you a sense of where, I mean, you look around today, it's very rare to find American Jewish materials produced with a union bug. But the commitment of American Jews to unionism was deep and quite profound in the first at least 60 years of the 20th century. That you had... Well, New York was a center of the printing industry. It was a unionized industry. In fact, I just recently walked by the Lithographers Union building, which is just off of Union Square. There were a lot of labor organizations, along with the Zionist organizations, Communist Party, and stuff like that, right around in this area. And the union bug was present. Used to have union labels on your challah, too, which would say that it came from union bakers. So the consciousness of labor is very important, and there's a lot in such a piece of material to get not just the external content of what it's saying to you, but also how it's printed and the other kinds of things that you can learn from looking at a document that way. So we've gotten a sense, I think, here about some public documents, about the private realm, about the ways in which these materials let us enter into the worlds and there are multiple worlds of Jewish women in the 20th century. We get a sense not just of the public and private, but also of the communal dimensions, obviously of the politics as well, of what's going on. What about, since many of you deal in the arts, is there anything here that is about the arts that you've come across in your what you've looked at? Well, who walked up to look at Molly? You did. Okay, so what did you notice in the scrapbook here?
Well, you know, pictures of her, it's what you remember. You know, there's a lot of publicity. A lot of it is in Yiddish, which surprised me. I didn't know how long the Yiddish continued. And I think it's longer than I remember it.
Okay. That's a good point. Yes. Yiddish, absolutely. Yiddish theater lasted longer, well in through the 50s and the first part of the 60s.
Right.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people don't realize how long that lasted.
Okay. So among the things that we have, and you asked me about other kinds of artists and writers, is that in the 20th century, we have Jewish women not only making a name for themselves as intellectuals or in politics, but also in the arts as writers, as photographers, as performers. And these materials are also often collected here. You had asked specifically about someone like Edna Ferber. They don't have Edna Ferber's materials, but there are a number of other writers whose materials. Oh yes, Edna Ferber was definitely Jewish. Yes. Yeah. I mean, she grew up in the Midwest, and right. Okay. Yes. Okay, so let me tell you, say something about collecting policies. One of the things that you seek, which is in a sense what you refer to, is that you want materials of your own. Let's say if you're going to donate something, you want it to go to an archive that has other types of similar materials, right? Because you don't just want someone to come to look to research your materials that you've donated. You want the element of serendipity. You want them going to research. I was just asked somebody about camps, right? Jewish camps, which there were a lot, and his father was the founder of a very important camp out in California, right? And you want someone who's doing work on camps, as it were, to stumble upon your materials as well, even if they hadn't set out to do that. So the closeness and the possibilities for interaction are very important. There also are some places where it's a pain to get to. even though, you know, people will sleep there. So, you know, Minnesota has a great immigration history archive, but, you know, one doesn't always want to go out to Minnesota to look at their immigration materials, for example. And that you might also keep in mind. But that's one of the grounds upon which one wants to collect. Now, I know that no one has told me anything about those ledgers. Somebody, yes, can you tell me something about those ledgers?
Yeah, I have these are from the National Council. Mm-hmm. Mostly written in the most beautiful polymer penmanship.
Good.
What struck me, this is from 1940, and this is a report on one of their triennial conventions on their legislative program. And I was struck by this because in my checkered past, I spent several decades as a congressional reporter for NBC News. And the legislative program of 1940 includes things like compulsory health insurance, social security, representation for the District of Columbia, FDA, on and on of issues that are still before us. And some that are not, like anti-lynching, poll tax, you know, things like that. But as you run down the list of items that on their legislative program, we're still dealing with many of the same issues. And they were clearly very, very interested in these.
Okay, so what I would emphasize there is, of course, the extent to which these American Jews were Americans. They cared very much about the United States. They were critical of a lot of things in the United States, things that were wrong with this country and that they wanted to make better. And that's from 1940, but it could have also been from 42 or 48. There was a sense that the United States needed to improve and that part of what they wanted to do was to make this a better country. Yes, what else? Didn't you have your hand up?
Yeah. But I was saying that saying, where's the art? Everybody's impression in personalizing what it is they viewed, as random as it was, that's the art. It's how you take what's there that you didn't even know you were looking for, and they're somehow able to transform it. I mean, I got the war documents, which would be the least likely box in front of the comedian. And so, I would think, like, what in this would be something if you had to make an expression? So if you looked at it from that way, what am I being presented with this, and where does it go from here? Then you don't have to collect only things with a capital A, art.
Okay, you're right. Thank you. I was hoping, that's why I wanted you to all to sort of engage with the materials themselves, because I realize this is an extraordinarily creative group of women, and that the materials can speak in various different ways to you. And I was hoping for exactly what we've just sort of encountered with this material. Okay, there's one other thing that hasn't been mentioned that I know is out there. Doesn't somebody have the Congress material that has some of the court cases? Yes. Okay, well, tell me about them, please.
One stack here is the Heidi Weissman employment discrimination suit that they fought when Heidi Weissman was accusing the Albert Einstein Medical Center of employment discrimination and sexual harassment, which feels like very recent history, 1988 to 1993, yesterday. And in this stack of the American Jewish Congress, fortunately, we have a cheat sheet here. discrimination and employment was the Heidi Weissman and a few other cases in the early 80s. And then, I guess, amicus briefs that had to do with the Violence Against Women Act and lawsuits that were brought under various... I mean, if American Jewish Congress saw itself as a lawyer for Jewish people, then the Women's Division saw that they needed to be out there arguing sort of pro-feminist,
Okay, so what I would want to underline from what you've just mentioned there is the fact that a number of really important cases were brought by Jews against Jews. And that we do not have a singular, unified Jewish community, that women have charged male-run organizations with discrimination and other issues. I mean, that one involved sexual harassment. And that the perspective that Jewish women bring to the Jewish world is not always the same as that shared by men. There are significant divisions between those of the women and those of the men. And such a court case is an example of that. The Congress itself brought lots of court cases and lots of amicus briefs, mostly in the realm of civil liberties and civil rights. But it took the women to bring the court cases that dealt specifically with women's issues. And often choosing a Jewish organization to bring the case against was a strategic move because of the way in which it sort of kept the argument, as it were, within the community and allowed for the two sides really to go at each other. Now, this was true when you looked at the early part of the 20th century where Jewish men and women struck against Jewish garment manufacturers. It was a Jewish-Jewish fight. Or you look a little later on as that gives you an example. So one should recognize that not only did the organizations have different perspectives, but that there was real inter-Jewish, or intra-Jewish, I should say, conflict. And that women brought conflict to the fore and were often criticized for that as well. Okay. Court cases, actually, can be sometimes the subject of poetry. I don't know how many of you are familiar with some of the poems of Charles Reznikoff, but he wrote some very, very moving poetry based on the Nuremberg trials and based on labor court cases, because he was also a lawyer in his day job. So there's material there for poetry too, if you're potentially interested. Yes.
I also don't think we can forget that there were Jewish women's organizations like Pioneer Women that was specifically Israel headed, specifically Pioneer Women. Also, I grew up in the Bronx and near Co-op City, and many of the young Jews and good men belonged to an organization called American Youth for Democracy, which our friend in Congress used to say, you know, when he was trying to handle Paul, like, quote, ex-Congress, I have a thing here that you want. But it was loaded with Jewish young people, American Jews.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, and, you know, we forget that period where that was not considered, I never considered it anti-American.
Okay.
So we forget those too.
You bring up, I think, also another important point, and that is this historical society doesn't collect everything. So if you really become interested in the involvement of Jews in various forms of the left, the main place to go is Tamamit.
Yes.
Which is a sort of sub-library within the NYU library system. Because although there are valuable materials here and at YIVO and to a certain extent at Leo Beck, the Tamamit has specialized in making an archive of the American left. There's also actually one at a smaller archive called the Labadie Collection out in Michigan as well. So Jews are not just involved, of course, in Jewish organizations. They are deeply involved in many aspects of American life. And what you've had a taste of today are some of the ways in which that involvement spills over into what can be seen as specifically Jewish, provided you have a sufficiently flexible understanding of what it means to be Jewish and American at the same time. I think I will end here and see if we've had questions and comments, so I think we're ready for our conclusion at this point, right?
Thank you for listening to this Lilith podcast. Check out the Lilith website for more podcasts, plus the Lilith blog, online anthologies, back issues, and much more. That's www.lilith.org.